really have an impedance to ground or impedance to the universe, even though that dipole is floating in orbit a mile away from the space shuttle, and you're just there with your spacesuit, if you know what I mean, doing these experiments. And by the way, there'd be a certain amount of capacitance to your body and to your spacesuit, but we won't go there. So as long as you've got the right kind of a balancing structure near the antenna, there's nothing magic about feeding the antenna in the center. But as you start feeding it further and further off to one side, you get the most efficient feed if you feed it with reference to ground. As Barry has found out, N2MB, and we're hearing the reports from him over the last week now, he has followed our suggestions. Mel and I have been suggesting for some time, let me drop. We've been suggesting for some time that a pure vertical half-wave dipole is an extremely high-performance antenna that has almost never been described in any of the available literature. And how I came about that one is to say that in the case of a quarter-wave ground plane antenna, a quarter-wave vertical antenna, you have to do heroic things, putting down a zillion ground plane radials, trying to make the earth in the backyard look like a great big sheet of copper in order to full performance. You're trying to make a perfect short circuit. Ain't no better short circuit in the world than another quarter wavelength of line into an open circuit. The impedance inversion of a quarter wavelength of line, whether it be called antenna, fed, transmission line, it's a beautiful way of making a short circuit. When you add the other quarter wavelength of line below, you're making a half-wave dipole. So, you accept the point that a pure vertical half-wave dipole is very high-performance antenna, very low angle of radiation, no ground plane radials are required. You could, if you desire, feed it in the center, and Barry is doing that now, but I'm trying to tell him also he has the ability to feed it at the bottom if he wants to. Feed it with reference to ground, a very simple feeding technique. And now he doesn't have to run the transmission line out there 30 feet away from the tower. Someday he's going to do that experiment. Someday I'm going to do that experiment. Mel wanted to tell us more about all of the above. KC2, KU, K2, KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Now, Roger, yeah, I was just going to say before, you know, when you were talking about lines, that I'll make a statement, basically. If the line was infinitely long and had no really resistance, in other words, really long, the pulse will actually travel undiminished along that line, I guess, forever. Correct? Over.
Absolutely. And that is the way you measure surge impedance of a transmission line. In other words, the characteristic impedance. If I've got an unknown transmission line, and as long as my instrumentation will allow me to issue a pulse that is brief enough compared to the line, you and I know that the speed of light is roughly 1 nanosecond per foot. If I've got 50 feet of an unknown line, I know that that length of line is such that even if the velocity factor was unity, if it was an air-filled line, it would take 50 nanoseconds for that signal to go from input end to the output end. It would take another 50 nanoseconds to reflect back. So I've got 50 feet of unknown line, air line. Worst case, as far as highest possible impedance, transmission speed is concerned, if I've got instrumentation that can issue a pulse less than 100 nanoseconds long, where I can measure the voltage and current I'm putting into the line, I am measuring the impedance of that line. Only when the pulse gets to the end of the line and reflects all the way back to my source do I now start seeing something else. But for that first, in my example, 99 nanoseconds, I will see the exact impedance of that line because from the point of view of the briefness of my pulse, that line appears to, during that 99 nanoseconds, to be infinitely long. So I'm really measuring the impedance of that line, and they call that surge impedance. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW.
Okay, let me translate that down because a lot of people are going to ask me, what do you say? I'm going to make it a little simpler. If we took a frequency of a voltage and we said, I'd say 10,000 hertz or 10 megahertz, each cycle would occupy 0.1 microseconds, as Dick just said. So a complete cycle would occur, will be present for along each of the 30 meters of line, because 10 megahertz, 10,000 hertz, 10 million hertz represents 0.1 microseconds or 10 megahertz. So what 10 megahertz is actually 30 meters. I think that'll be a little simpler explanation how it comes about, Dick. Over.
Okay, we've added another factor here, Mel. You're doing the test with AC signal. You want to measure the impedance of your cable at, in your example, 10 megahertz. I was doing it with a pure DC pulse, but a very brief pulse. In other words, I've got an oscilloscope that I'm going to trigger at the instant I close the contacts, and I'm issuing a 1-volt pulse down this line. And so the scope starts sweeping at the instant the contacts close, and I've got the scope sweeping fast that only 100 nanoseconds is on the screen. And I've got 50 feet of unknown transmission line. So I'm putting a 1-volt pulse into this transmission line, and I did it through a known impedance signal generator. It could be a 2-volt battery with a 50-ohm resistor in series with it. That is a 50-ohm signal generator. A 2-volt battery with a 50-ohm resistor in series with the switch. At the instant I close the switch, I'm starting the sweep of the scope, and the scope probe is looking at the voltage on the unknown transmission line. By looking at that voltage, I will know the exact impedance of that line for the first 99.9 nanoseconds, because it's going to take at least that amount of time for the pulse that I sent down there, the DC pulse, to hit the end and reflect back. When the pulse reflects back, funny things start happening. There's a whole bunch of puzzles you can go into on that one. I won't go there right now. But whether that line be 50 feet long in my example, 50 miles long, for the first 99.9 nanoseconds, I couldn't tell the difference. So if I got an infinite length of line, I just simply connect a resistor and a battery to it, and I measure the voltage, and it's the same way that your ohmmeter works.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
In fact, if my line was infinite in length, I could measure its impedance with an ohmmeter. I simply connect the ohmmeter there. The ohmmeter is a flashlight battery with a resistor, and the current that flows through that resistor is what gets registered on that meter, and the amount of current on that meter tells you how many ohms that resistor is. So if my line was truly infinite in length, I simply connect an ohmmeter to it, and until it went an infinite length of time for the pulse coming out of the ohmmeter, going down the line and coming back, will disturb the apparent impedance. So an ohmmeter really is a battery with a resistor and a voltage measuring device. And you get 0 volts if I put it across the 0-ohm resistor. If I put it across an infinite ohm resistor, I measure the battery voltage. So measuring a resistor with an ohmmeter and measuring the surge impedance of a coax cable with a DC signal has a strong similarity, as long as you've got the timing set up correctly. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. You have it exactly the way I was going to really put it. At the speed of light, as Dick would say, the pulse travels 30 meters along the line in a 0.1 microsecond. So it will travel 60 meters in 0.2 microseconds, 90 meters in 0.3 microseconds, and so on and so forth. So that's it. So as now, let me see how else I was going to say. Okay, the current along, let's see, how I'm going to put this in right words, because I got to get the right wording. The current along the line really does not exist along the wires until actually, until the pulse has actually reached its travel, that there is no, in other words, there is no current actually until, in other words, until it's terminated, that's when the pulse occurs. I think that's the right way to put it, Dick. Over.
That's good, and I'm going to try to make it even simpler. I'm going to try to boil it down to a mechanical example. Let's assume that I yank the rain gutter off of my house, and I've got it sitting in my garage floor, and I've got water in that rain gutter. I've blocked up the hole, so the water is sitting in the rain gutter, and I push my hand against the water at one end of the rain gutter. I'm creating a wave, and I watch that wave walk down the gutter. And after a certain length of time, the wave hits the far end and reflects back. Or, correspondingly, I can take a great big long guy wire that's on my 100-foot-high tower, and I put my eye against the guy wire, and I tap my hand against the guy wire. I create a deflection of the wire, which looks like a pulse, and I watch that pulse go up the wire and strike the tower. After it strikes the tower, which is a short circuit, the pulse reverses in polarity. If it was a down-going pulse, it becomes an up-going pulse, and it starts traveling back toward me. So in either of those cases, or if I had the right kind of animation, let me drop. I could make an animation, which is a slow-motion movie of a signal traveling down a transmission line, where the signal changes size or color or whatever, and I watch the signal walk across the screen at the speed of propagation in that media. But because it's a slow-motion movie, I watch this pulse slowly go across the screen. So the impedance that my hand feels that pushes against that walk in that trough is really measuring the surge impedance of that so-called transmission line, water in a gutter, or my hand pressing against the wire, my guy wire, is kind of measuring impedance. I put a certain number of pounds of force with my hand, I get a certain amount of deflection of the wire. If I tighten the guy wire more, I'm making a lower impedance transmission line. It takes more force to get the same amount of deflection. Or with that trough of water, if I used a heavier substance than water, like mercury, it would be a lower impedance transmission line. The amount of force required of my hand to push the water or mercury in that trough is measuring its impedance. That impedance is going to change, though, when that wave travels down the trough, hits the end, and reflects back. Now my hand is going to sense something different, something more complicated. So when you're measuring these impedances of a transmission line, you got to get the timing right. You got to make sure that the pulse that you put on there, with your ohm meter, with your pulse generator, with your closed set of contacts on a battery and a resistor, you got to make sure that the timing is right so that the pulse doesn't get a chance to go down your transmission line and come back. Because when it does, you're going to measure some other impedance which is not right. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly, because if it moves along that line, and that line was infinitely long and had no resistance, the pulse would travel undiminished forever. However, when the pulse, as Dick says, when the pulse reaches its travel, at this point, it is present then in both wires, and the electron moving in one direction in one wire, and in the other direction in the other wire. That's what takes place. This is what we're talking about, basically what you would, if you could visualize what happens at the time of termination. Now, you brought up another point about these different random wire systems and why to use, say, 450-ohm open wires, like, for instance, some antennas that they have, like, that they're selling. What the heck do they call that antenna that they're selling? I'm trying to remember that thing. Feeding a single, what do they call it, they have a name for that thing, and I can't think of it. It's a flat top wire, a random length flat top, non-resonant, antenna, feeding it for multi-band operation. Dick, what the heck do they call that, over?
Are you talking about that antenna fire, that very miniature thing that measures voltage? Maybe so. Let me Let me pass one other piece of information here, which will help. One of the best-kept secrets in the world. I have never seen it properly written in any of the respected books. The transmission line section of the antenna book, of the handbook from ARRL, beautiful book, and there's a whole lot of other books explaining transmission lines. But the best-kept secret of a transmission line that I haven't read anywhere is that it keeps the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal thoroughly separate. That's a hard one to believe. You put a pulse of any voltage, any frequency you like. You're sending it from the shack toward the antenna outside the shack. And if somebody else is connecting another signal generator at the far end and sending a signal back, I don't care what frequency, what pulse, whatever, those two signals are meeting in the middle of your transmission line. One's going up the line, one's coming down. The magic of the transmission line. Let me drop. That as long as you're using the transmission line within its performance maximum, in other words, you're not making a signal so big that it's arcing over the line or overheating it or whatever, as long as you're using it within its normal size parameters, it will keep those two signals thoroughly separate. The signal flowing from north to south is not interfered with in the slightest way with the signal that's flowing from south to north. And it doesn't matter if the signal going up and the signal coming back are the exact same signal that got reflected from an antenna. The transmission line keeps them completely separate. You can see this by using a puddle of water as a transmission line. Drop a pebble into the north side, and a set of rings of waves will travel toward the south. Drop a pebble into the south side, some waves will travel to the north. Drop a pebble into the north side and the south side of a pebble, a puddle simultaneously, and you'll watch those waves fold through each other with no interaction effect, as long as the waves are small enough that you're not running into white caps and nonlinearity. If I tap the wire of my guy wire, and my eye is against it, and I'm looking at the pulse going up the line, and I tap it vertically, and before that pulse goes up the line, hits the tower, and reflects, comes back, I tap a second pulse horizontally. And I'll watch those two pulses walk through each other on that guy wire. The guy wire is a kind of transmission line. All transmission lines behave in this way. It's a very hard thing to believe. You have to dig into the mathematics of the pointing vector to figure out how the transmission line does it. But those signals are going in opposite directions on the exact same line, and they're kept thoroughly separate. The free space that's in the room with you, let me drop. The free space that's in the room with you also does this. You have a radio signal that's west of you, a radio transmitter west of you, broadcast station, let me drop. You got a broadcast station that's west of you, you got a broadcast station that's east of you, and you're in the middle. And those two waves in free space are folding through each other in free space, and they have absolutely no interaction with each other, as long as you didn't arc over the air and create a nonlinearity. You may get some intermodulation distortion in your radio because those two signals are only a mile away and they're super strong, and your radio is being shoved. And your radio is being shoved into a nonlinearity. Those intermods that you hear, intermodulation distortions, are being created in your radio. Mother Nature did not do that. So all transmission lines obey this kind of reciprocity, superposition, call it what you like. Signals are kept thoroughly separate. Once you understand that, you have a good chance of understanding the magic that takes place within a directional coupler. But now we're getting off subject. But that's an extremely valuable component, and at many flea markets, they're sitting there for $5, they're worth $1,000, everybody turns up their nose because they don't know what it is. Be amazed how valuable that tool is. I know we've gone off subject, but I better send it back to you, Mel. But the measuring surge impedance, you have to worry about the pulse coming back because it's going to change things when it gets back to you. You got to make sure the timing is right. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right. Let's say now that hypothetically a number of people always ask this question. I think we covered it pretty well, but, you know, let's go back and say, well, you know, we have room for, say, 100 feet of wire. That's it. and we'd like to, you know, and this is the constraints, maybe we have to sneak the wire, use stuff that's almost invisible, whatever happens to be the situation. And you'd like to use it on, say, somewhere between 160 and 10 meters. You can well imagine that the matching where it's going to be. First of all, this is a random length, and now you're going to have an antenna feed point that's going to vary. You can well imagine from 160 meters through 10 meters, and why use open wire feeders? This is a question that comes up fairly, and I think we sort of discussed it, but being that we're on the subject now of open wire feeders, why you would use an open wire feeder in this case, Dick, over.
As the high power broadcast engineers on places like Mackay Radio and RCA Laboratory, Press Wireless and whatever, as they discovered a long time ago, the lowest loss, very high power transmission line is open wire line. The only restriction you've got is don't bring it near other pieces of metal, don't make sharp bends in it, and don't have the spacing between the lines be very much longer than a small fraction of a wavelength. You obey those rules, feed it in a thoroughly differential manner. It's a very well-shielded, very low-loss structure. Rich N2EL ran into the problem where he had I think it was an 80-meter or a 40-meter dipole, and he wanted to feed it on multiple bands. And on the band where the dipole is a half wave, and you got something close to 72 ohms, and if you're using, in my example, 72-ohm transmission line, no sweat. But when you go to some other band, if I take an 80-meter dipole, which is 72 ohms on 80 meters, and I decide to feed it at twice the frequency, 40 meters, that impedance you're going to see is going to be something like 1,500 ohms, mostly capacitor reactants, correction inductive reactants, but you're going to see a huge impedance. Therefore, your transmission line, any reasonable transmission line, is going to see an extremely high standing wave ratio. In other words, the far end of the line is not being properly matched. If it was 72 ohm line in my example, and you're going to have almost 100-to-1 standard wave ratio. As such, you can go to the right curve in the antenna book, and you'll find out that when a piece of transmission line is used at a high standing wave ratio, there's an additional loss that takes place. The additional loss is a multiplication of the loss that the line normally has. If you're smart enough to start off with a line where the loss is so low, and you
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You start off with a line where the insertion loss at your frequency is so low that when you multiply it 10 times higher, you only come up to a tenth of a dB, no sweat. But if your particular line at your frequency has a dB of loss, and because of extremely high standing wave ratio, you multiply that by 10, and now you've got 10 dB of loss, people are not going to think you're very loud. You know, 90% of your power is lost, and only 10% of it's being radiated, to round off the numbers. So, when you're using antennas that you know at some of the frequencies you desire to use them are going to be very far from the good impedances, you better be using extremely low transmission line loss, and open wire line is the best in the world. When N2EO first fed his dipole with coax on those other bands, he was very unhappy with the performance. He flipped over to open wire line with the right kind of an antenna tuner, and all of a sudden he's gangbusters. So it's that multiplication factor of loss that takes place when the standing wave ratio is high. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, exactly. You definitely hit it on the button, or as they say, the nail on the head, because you take, for instance, people that want a force, like you say, you take an antenna, like 100 foot of wire, a random non-resonant length of wire, and they decide to put it on, let's say, 160 or even 80 meters. On 80 meters, you can get it within reason, an SWR of about 20 to 1. You go to 160 and it goes up 20 times. So it's a situation now where if you want to really use this antenna and really want to get something that will, like you say, get out of your backyard, you use 450 ohm feeders, and it makes the net difference between night and day. That's the bottom line, Dick. This I've showed to people many a time. I can tell you a funny instance about a guy I know that put up an antenna system, and he had hundreds of feet open wire running when I originally suggested to him, and then somebody said, of course, on 35 meters to some of the smart alecks there that say things off the top, oh, the losses you've got is tremendous. And he went ahead and bought hundreds of feet of coax for a fortune, and then found the goddamn thing. People that he talked to usually every day said, oh, we can't hardly hear you anymore. So this is just matter of fact that you hear every day on especially 75 that the worst thing to use is open wire feed. It's over.
Run that one by again. You saying that open wire feeder is the worst thing to use on 80 meters. That was the last sentence. I wonder if that was... I'm misinterpreting it. Over to you, Mel.
Well, that's what they said. They told him on 75 meters. See, I had suggested this guy has a setup that he's like in sort of like a valley. He's located in Tennessee. And he told me his situation. I says, well, I'll tell you what. You want to try an antenna? I told him about the loop and everything and how to feed it with the open wire feeder, which he went ahead and he did, and he was on and he was doing real well with it until he got a hold of some supposedly expert. And he says, oh, no, he says, this is wrong. You know, the open wire feeders is not the way to go. And he told him about putting a coax cable. The loss will be less with coax. And he went ahead and he put coax running hundreds of feet of coax. It cost him a blooming fortune for a roll of 500 foot of coax. And he hooked it all up, like they said, with a rebellion up there in the business. And then he found that people that he talks to regularly, all of a sudden they said, what happened? Your signal is not there. Oh, must be my amplifier is not working right. Must be this. And when I finally had told him, I said, what happened there? You know, what transpired from the time I talked to you until now that you're complaining? And he told me what he did. He said, oh, this low loss Andrew or whoever's cable he bought, you know, the high-end cable, LMR maybe, whatever, if he spent a lot of money, he says he put that, and now it doesn't work as well. Now, there's the situation. The open wire feeder surely works better. And this consists situation, Dick, but this is what you'll hear all the time. Oh, that's the worst way to go is with open wire feed. It's over.
Properly used, open wire feeder is going to give you about the lowest loss you're ever going to get on HF frequencies. But there's a number of ways you can misuse it. But in order for you to remember this philosophy that if you've got an antenna that you know at some of the frequencies you're going to use it on, it's an extremely high standing wave ratio. Therefore, you're going to get a multiplication of the loss of that line. That's one way to memorize it, but to know why, maybe we'll make it a little bit more easy. When you've got an antenna that's got the wrong impedance compared to your line, if I've got 50 ohm coax cable and I've got a 200 ohm antenna, that is by definition, a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. Divide 50 into 200, you come up with 4. There will be a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. What is standing wave ratio? It really is reflected power coefficient. Okay? So once I've got this 4-to-1 impedance match, and the transmitter is going to be unhappy, unless I use an antenna tuner, or I've got a large enough range to the tuning and loading controls of my old-fashioned DX100 transmitter, or maybe even a Collins rig, anyhow, by one means or another, I force an impedance match. Everyone thinks that the antenna tuner, with a high reflected power from the antenna, that the antenna tuner simply throws away the power. It runs ice cold, it doesn't radiate it, it uses that power. When you properly adjust the antenna tuner, so that it gives you a proper impedance match between that transmitter and that crazy antenna, you didn't realize it, but you thought you're doing an impedance match. Simultaneously, what you were doing is presenting just the right reactance and impedance in the antenna tuner so that every single smidgen of all of that reflected power from the antenna gets re-reflected forward. Not only re-reflected forward, every bit of it, but it's e-reflected forward exactly in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter right now. And the two add together in a voltage manner. Take my word for it. So, if you've got a high standing wave ratio antenna, all of the reflected power gets re-reflected forward. That's not the end of the story. That new re-reflected forward power plus the power your transmitter is making right now is going to still go back and see the exact same antenna with that 200 ohm impedance in my example. And still a certain significant percentage of it, I think like almost half the power, is going to be re-reflected back. The bottom line is the real power you radiate doesn't get out there directly when you've got a high visor on the line. It's reflecting back and forth multiple times on the transmission line. I'm going to round off the numbers a whole lot, but if you've got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, you could say the power on your transmission line has to bounce back and forth 10 times before you finally radiate it. You're really radiating a little bit on each bounce, and a hell of a lot of it gets sent back to the transmitter and gets re-reflected forward by the antenna tuner. That's where the extra loss is coming from. The power is not making the trip in one single step. It's bouncing back and forth a whole lot of times. On each trip through your transmission line, it's being attenuated by the loss factor of your transmission line. So now you know the bottom line, at the molecular level almost, why does a high VISWR create
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now you know why a high VISWR on your transmission line creates a lot more loss, a multiplication of the insertion loss. It's really the multiplication caused by the fact that the power is flowing through there multiple times before it gets radiated. I'm not convinced that many of the books have made that clear. There's a curve there that a lot of people don't know about, showing you the extra loss factor for your known loss of cable because of the standing wave ratio. And your known loss of cable could be either because you're using a poor quality cable or you're using a whole lot of it. Doesn't matter. I could be using a medium quality cable and a whole lot of it, or a very high, low quality cable, but very little of it. If both of them have the same amount of loss for the signal flowing one way, and if both of them have the same standing wave ratio of the antenna, in both cases I'll get the exact same loss factor. So you can see how the problem gets more aggravated as your transmission line becomes longer. So for any of these systems where you're trying to not use a fan dipole, you're just a simple piece of wire and you want to use it on a whole lot of bands, and if you're smart enough to know that on some of those bands the antenna is going to really be a terrible standing wave ratio, you better be using something very low in loss, like open wire line. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this, give me a call. Letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2EAB has a comment.
Okay. The peripatetic, Mr. Ed. Go right ahead, Ed.
Let me know what you think about this thing. Einstein used to call them thought experiments. Don't try it. Just think. You take a mismatched antenna. You hook it up with a good coax, a good antenna tuner, with a kilowatt amp. You get it set up so you're putting on a nice signal. You then remove the good coax and replace it with a really totally inadequate third-rate coax. Fire it up again and increase the power until the coax arcs over. Do an autopsy on the coax. See where it arced over. Replace it with an identical crummy coax. It'll always arc over in the same place because of the phasing relationship and where you get those voltage peaks. That shows you how predictable and repeatable SWR is. What do you think about that, Dick?
Yeah, I believe that, and I've seen people actually run into that situation, Ed. The signal flowing forward and the signal flowing back when you've got a high standing wave ratio, although the signal flowing forward and flowing back do not mix, do not interfere with each other, they still produce, which is kind of crazy, places on the line where the voltage is maximum and places on the line where the current is maximum. and those two places are displaced by a quarter wave. You get a peak of voltage every half wave, you get a peak of current every half wave, and the peak of current and the peak of voltage are a quarter wave apart. I think the mathematics of that is right, but we can double check that. But where the voltage is maximum is where you're most likely going to arc over the cable. Where the current is maximum, where you're going to get the most amount of heat before you arc it over. And so is the cable failing because of excess heat or failing because of excess voltage? That's a function of your particular brand of cable and its mode of failure. But in either case, you do the experiment three times in a row with the same length of cable. Or that doesn't have to be the same length of cable. The failure mechanisms of the same type of cable will always occur at the exact same positions as long as you're measuring those positions as distances back from the antenna, not from the transmitter. You measure back from the antenna. That's the thing that's making the standing wave ratio. And if on the first piece of cable you've got a failure 4.5 feet back from the antenna, in theory the next piece of cable is going to again fail 4.5 feet back from the antenna. Let's see if that's what Ed is saying. To the B2EAV, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. It's just that if the cables are identical, it doesn't matter which end you from. But yes, if they're not identical, you have to measure from the antenna.
So it turns out that mismatched antenna, standing wave ratio, what you see in the shack and whatever, all of these are deterministic functions. I've got a set of equations built into my little handheld calculator where if someone tells me the exact impedance of the load, whether it be antenna or the next stage of a transmitter or whatever, if you know the exact impedance at the other end of the cable, reactive component and resistive component, and their magnitudes, and you tell me the length of the cable and the velocity factor of the cable, I plug it into this relatively simple formula. It's not so simple. It's got a bunch of tangents and sines and cosines. It'll tell me the exact impedance you're going to see at the input end of that cable. And there are times when that's very handy. On that example that Mel and I were talking about earlier where your particular antenna tuner only covers a certain portion of the Smith chart, with that knowledge, you know exactly how much cable to add in the shack in order to force your particular antenna to fall into the sweet spot of the Smith chart where your antenna tuner does the best job of tuning. And so you'd be amazed how calculatable each of these situations are, even though at first they sound like kind of black magic. It's just a matter of getting enough experience. People who have been around for a whole lot of years learned an awful lot of these tricks. You'd be amazed how many tricks there are in the RF world that are not covered in the classes and not covered in the books. Mel and I have often said that 90% of the knowledge that allows us to live in the RF world did not come from the beautiful schools that we went to, and for the most part did not come from the beautiful books that we've read. They came from real hands-on experiment and talking to people. K2RIW listening.
NG2B.
NG2B. Start off with your name, sir, and your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Hello, Dick. My name is Steve. And my question is just if we can, if you know anything about G-line, if you can talk about G-line in regards to the, you know, the topic of tonight, and of course there's open wire feeders, but I've been intrigued with G-line. I'm just wondering if you have anything you can say about it.
Yeah, there's been a whole lot of experiments on G-line. G stands for Gabu. A guy named Gabu invented this line. Just like ordinary transmission lines, whether it be open wire line or coaxial cable, 99% of the time, you see two conductors with your eye. In the case of coax cable, you got a center conductor and you got outer conductor. You can imagine the signal flowing down the center conductor and coming back down the outer conductor in order to complete the circuit. And the same thing with open wire line, twin lead, two conductors. All of a sudden, there's two other kinds of transmission lines. Well, there's 15 kinds of transmission line, but two of the others, waveguide only has one conductor. It's a hollow pipe, so to speak. And this Gabu line is another one. This Gabu line, you start off with what looks like the center conductor of a coax cable. And there's supposed to be a certain thickness of dielectric material on top of that center conductor. And once you launch the signal correctly on that single conductor with this dielectric material on the outside of it, it will act like a transmission line. That's the good news. The bad news is supporting it is a real dog of a problem. Launching the signal and receiving the signal at the far end is a real dog of a problem. You've got this very long wavelength, multiple wavelength thing that looks like a feed horn that launches that crazy signal onto that G line. So in the real world, it's kind of hard to use. Very few people have ever used it. It's an interesting experiment as an HF kind of transmission line. When rain is on the line, it's going to change its characteristics. It's kind of difficult to do a good job of launching and a good job of receiving it on the other end. So I don't recommend it. It's an interesting science experiment. It's a not very practical line. But in the ideal world, it's capable of fairly low loss at HF frequencies.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So now, once you know that something is called G-line or GABU line, I'm not quite sure how GABU is spelled, in the good books on transmission lines and antennas, and if you Google those words, you will find more information on it. I wonder if that's approximately what you've heard, Steve. NG2B, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
K2KEY, want to comment on it?
Yeah, go ahead, Mel. I'm going to go to Mel first and then back to Steve. Go ahead, Mel.
That was an interesting paper that was written by George G. But he doesn't spell with an E. He spelled it G-E-O-R-G. And his last name was G-O-U. Let me picture it. G-O-U. B-A-U, GABU. And it basically, he came up with this idea. It wasn't for HF. It was never proposed, this line, for HF. He said it would serve very well from 400 megs up, and claimed under 1 dB loss per 100 feet. And because basically he went through the whole speech, of course, saying like stuff like RG8U and all is actually worthless. RG8 cable and all is always worthless up into the UHF zone. So he came up with this G-line, which was basically similar to what was known as a ground wave or a surface wave propagation of cable, Dick, over.
I'm very glad you reminded me of more of the information. I made it sound like it's only a low frequency. Yes, it is a microwave antenna. It does propagate by something called surface wave. And in order for that surface wave to really not radiate from the cable has to be out straight. If it's got a catenary curve to it, it starts radiating. So to really use it is difficult. Straight up the side of a tower at a microwave frequency, I think you could use it. But nowadays, we've come a long way of much lower loss lines with foam-filled cables and whatever. We have lines of such low loss, even at microwave frequencies, that you have to really go this route. It's not popular. I don't know of an installation that's using it today. And that leads me to believe that there's a bunch of problems. Rain getting on it, it's one of them. The dielectric material being out in the air exposed to ultraviolet all the time is another one that's going to be changing characteristics. Launching it and receiving the signal at the two ends is a dog, keeping the line straight, supporting it. I mean, if I'm running up 100 feet of tower with this stuff and there's no good way of supporting it at intermediate positions without disturbing its impedance, you can see how difficult it is to do. So I think it's not a popular technique. Over to you, Steve. I wonder what you've heard about it. NG2B, are you tempted to run an experiment with it? K2RIW in the TechNet?
It must not touch the tower either.
That's for sure. It can't touch anything. It can't even touch a support insulator. Over to you, Steve.
NG2B, yeah, that's the problem. where I wanted to utilize it, and yes, I am tempted to do some experimentation with it. I have been for a couple of years now. I've read the patents and all, you know, anything and everything I could find on it. And I was just curious on your thoughts on it, Dick. But nonetheless, you know, I know about the launching, almost like a cone, I guess, like the cones you'd pick up on the road, launching cones and whatnot. But overall, I mean, from the perspective of what I would need us to do here, I'm talking about probably about 300 feet, and it's very hard to tension a piece of wire at 300 feet without some sort of insulators or something lifting it, so it does become a problem. But it was very interesting reading to read the patents and some of the testing that was done. And I think from a smaller perspective, something maybe, you know, close to the house here with a tower going up, I think I might try to do some experimentation. But it would probably be in the UHF range, you know, or VHF range. But overall, I thought it was intriguing to read the experiments that had been done. And I think I think it was done in the 50s, if I'm not mistaken. The 50s. 1956 or something like that. Maybe a little earlier. Anyway, back over to Net, NG2B.
I think there are a couple of issues of the Bell System Technical Journal in the 50s describing the experiments that were done with this. If you do run an experiment, successful or unsuccessful, Steve, I hope you come back and tell us what you find. But the fact that you and I cannot point to a commercial installation that's using it gives me pretty strong indication that it's not easy to use, not popular, it's got some problems. You take, for instance, another kind of antenna called a periscope antenna. Some people call it the fly swatter. There's still a number of installations where it's being used, particularly on mountaintop locations. So it's got a lot going for it, and it's really demonstrating its performance, whereas the G-Line doesn't seem to be demonstrating its performance in anywhere that I know about in the last 20 years, so to speak. So I know there's got to be some other hidden problems, even beyond the ones that we know about. I think we've gone down the list of people who have signed in. Let me double-check to make sure I haven't missed anybody. Speak now, and if not, we're going to go into the deeper subjects. Anyone that we missed, give me your call, letters, and name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, let me tell you a final word about G-Line. Maybe it'll help them.
Give us those words, Mel.
How do I remember G-Line? Back in the 1950, there was the proceedings of the IRE, which, you know, that time they called it the IRE. And they had a whole thing about this miracle line called the GABU line, or the single conductor surface wave transmission line. That's what it was known as, the single conductor surface wave transmission line. So if you're interested also in following up on this, you'll find it in the procedure of the IRE, I believe it was the early 50s, between 50 and 53. And you'll look on the single conductor surface wave transmission line. And the problem is, like you say, don't bend it. You can't bend it. You can't put it up any metallic and all. But a very interesting concept that Mr. G-O-B-A-U. Kaboom. Okay, that's the final. Go ahead, Dick.
Now, I think, John, I bet you and Wesley have come up with some questions that you would like to go deeper into this week. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick. No, I'll defer to Wesley. I'm holding off my question. I was just going to listen this week. I eat up enough of the time, so you can pick it up with Wes. Thank you.
And there's one, if Glenn is available, there's one other point I want to make with Glenn as we got deep into what's going on with heating up substances like air and what really happens to those outer ring of electrons. If Glenn is available, I want to ask him a very direct question, which is a carryover from last week. KC2QIQ, K2RW, are you there, Glenn?
Believe it or not, Dick, I'm still here. KC2QIQ.
Okay. You were expressing last week a fairly strongly felt opinion that as you heat up air molecules, for instance, if I've got I got O2 molecules, just to keep it simple, I got O2 molecules in a container and I'm heating them up, and you felt that the outer electrons go to a higher orbit when you heat them. And I've got a problem with that, and multiple problems. Number one, is that I know I can heat the O2 molecules in a continuous manner. I can start off at 25 degrees C. I can make them 25.1, 25.2, 50.1, 50.2, 150.1, 150.2 degrees centigrade. I can make continuous heating. And if the heating was creating expanded orbits of the outer electrons, the problem is that we know that those outer electrons can only be in very specific locations called eigenvalues. How can I get a continuous heating increase of those air molecules if they only are allowed to be in very specific orbits? How can I get those intermediate temperatures? I think they don't do that. I think if I hit those air molecules with a very specific frequency, yes, I can expand them, I can excite them. That's how a laser works. In the case of a laser, you're putting a very specific frequency from the pump into your gaseous material, in, for instance, a helium neon laser. And yes, I am exciting those molecules and that gas to a higher orbit, and when they jump back down, they give off that very specific wavelength that a helium neon laser gives off, 746 nanometers, I think it is. I've forgotten the exact number, but you know what I mean. So ordinary heating with a oven of O2, I...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm saying heating O2 air molecules in my oven does not do that because I don't see that characteristic wavelength coming back out when they cool off. And I can get a continuous flow of temperature without these jumps in temperature that would have to take place if it was the orbits expanding. Those are my feelings on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, I think you're onto something here, though, Dick. I mean, generally what you're saying is correct, but here's the interesting thing. Every element in our universe has an internal frequency to it at which it'll absorb more energy. Like water. Water will absorb energy very easily between, say, 5 and 15 microns. Other materials will be a different frequency. And, you know, here again, if you were to excite it externally with an electromagnetic field, you know, between 5 and 15, you know, body of water with 5 and 15 microns, it'll start absorbing it. And how is it going to absorb it? Through the valence shell of the electron. The electron movement will start at some point raising the temperature of that water to within, you know, certain limits, of course, before boiling point or freezing point or other things in between. But then it starts working in a volume because you have to realize that there's penetration. And then in other words, the wave will penetrate a certain part of the body. Those will start transferring energy to the elements next to it. And it just works as a chain reaction working its way through. So until it actually levels up the heating of the whole body, then the water temperature will rise depending on, you know, how fast the energy is dispersing or exchanging throughout the whole volume of whatever the material is. Back to you, to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question?
Need photons to raise electrons to the next level.
Question?
And are you saying, Ed, that those photons must be at a particular wavelength? Is that what you're saying, Ed?
Yes, you need photons at a specific energy level to raise electrons by that energy level, but there's only very discreet places where, however, the energy is okay, because it includes the frequency you want. I worked on ruby lasers. They depended on using this broadband arc lamp to put an incredible amount of light on the laser crystal in order to get enough energy at the resonant frequency.
Yeah, I have a comment to that also, Dick.
Question?
Now, let's go to Wesley first and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Wesley.
I was away from the radio for a moment. I wonder how much I've lost. My particular question was, if we have the square poles with the with modulation, then what would be the frequency to at which the water particles would split to the gas? And and I wonder if you're covering that subject. I'm sorry about it.
Yeah, part of this is a carryover from last week about what a microwave oven does and how it heats up water molecules. But now to make it simpler, we talked about O2 molecules heated up with an ordinary oven, the one that's in my kitchen. And the heating element of that oven does not put out the right wavelength to excite the electrons to higher orbits of those O2 molecules in my example. Yes, I could choose a wavelength where I could get laser-like action out of those O2 molecules, I believe, and I could excite them to a higher energy level. But an ordinary heating rod in a microwave oven, ordinary convection oven, I say does not do that. What I am saying is that your thermometer measures temperature. Temperature of a gas is the average kinetic energy of those gas molecules. The kinetic energy is primarily translational energy. It is a speed. The air molecules in the room with you right now, Glenn, are moving at an average speed of 500 meters per second. And if I heat up the room air in your room, they'll be moving slightly faster in translational speed greater than 500 meters per second. That's what the thermometer measures. I'm saying the thermometer does not measure the expansion of those electrons around each oxygen molecule to a higher orbit. I don't think the thermometer measures that. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I think on the contrary. I'll give you two simple examples. If you have a resistor and you put DC into it, it will eventually start to heat. And that heating is going to have an FIR, a frequency range in the low infrared area. if you take 60 cycles into tungsten, it'll give you white visible light. And that's going to be at a visible light frequency. There again, as I said, every molecule and atom in nature has its own absorption frequency. When you apply energy to it, now exactly how you're applying the energy, it doesn't really matter. But then again, remember, there's thermal dynamics. To transfer thermal energy, depending on what the initial source was, all you need is conductivity. So in other words, if you take another body and put it close to it, it will start drawing that heating on. But if you were to put an infrared meter on that, you will see the frequency at which that energy is being absorbed and heating up that body. And depending on what the material is going to determine what that frequency is. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You said that frequency, and there I disagree. The so-called Rolle-Jeans displacement law tells me that as I take, for instance, a solid body of black body material, resistive material, but it's a solid, and I heat it, or I don't heat it, there is a curve of emissivity. In other words, watts per square meter per cycle per second. There is a curve of what energy at what frequency is coming out of the thing. It's a very broad curve. As I heat it, the place where the curve peaks moves to a higher frequency, but it is emitting all frequencies at once, not a specific frequency. The peak of the curve of its emission goes to a higher frequency, and as I make it hot enough where it gets red and yellow and white, the peak has moved to that frequency and my eye is responding to it, but it's putting out all frequencies. That 50-ohm resistor that's in that dummy load that's on your table right now, if I plug it into the right kind of a receiver, I will measure minus 114 dBm per megacycle of random noise coming out of that 50-ohm resistor. And if I heat that 50-ohm resistor to 100 degrees centigrade, I can calculate exactly how much extra noise energy, broadband noise energy, essentially DC to light. Yes, there was a peak in the curve, and it eventually falls off as there was smaller wavelengths. It doesn't emit a specific frequency. It emits all frequencies. One thing left to discuss is, what does that frequency curve look like? And the peak of the curve moves when it gets hotter. That's not a specific frequency, as I see it, Glenn. It can't get any more broad than that. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
remember, like I was saying before, in other words, if you look at water, it's between, water will start absorbing energy between like 5 to 15 microns, right, in wavelength. If you look at